Oftentimes, it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education. And I should say I'm not really with Dan. We are socially distancing. We are not in studio today. We are on Zoom, and our guest will also be on Zoom.
Denise, deep fake Pope.
Oh, Dan,
I don't know if that, is that really you?
This is me. Oh, I see, because you're not sure, because I'm not in studio with you.
Right.
But it is my face that you are looking at on Zoom, and I am speaking.
Yeah, I wish I knew some private question that I know only you would know the answer.
Right. What was the color of my first car? No, just those password questions.
White. You know? White.
You're right. Dan, you're right.
So people often talk about critical thinking, you know, and when they get confused about what that is, like critical thinking, does that mean you think logically? You know, that might be critical thinking. Critical thinking is the processes by which you go about deciding what to believe. Mm. So critical thinking is really about how do people form beliefs and then from those decide to take actions. So one way to do that and form belief is to go in an echo chamber, right? And so an echo chamber is where you hear things that you already believe. And they contributed that. So in the current dual pandemics that we have right now, one is the novel coronavirus. The other one is the not so novel racism. I can choose which news feeds that I want to feed my political leanings and form my opinions. But right now, I sort of want to focus on deception and rather than people self-choosing. Deception is sort of like where I am unwitting that anything is being manipulated. Right. I don't know that I haven't chosen this and I'm inclined to believe it's true because I don't know any better. So a good question here is whether I'm good at detecting deception. Right. I think we all try and test ourselves on this. So I think I'm pretty good face to face figuring out if someone is trying to mislead me. I can poke a little bit. I look at the twitch of their eye. But, you know, online, I'm a complete fool. It's just so Stanford sends out fake phishing emails to educate us. And something shows up in the email. And I fall for them every time. So, like, you get a fake email from FedEx says that I need to click to get a package. Who doesn't want a package?
Oh,
you know, I click
Dan.
On it, and then I go to the site that says, you are a fool. Take these steps, you know. So how about you, Denise? Are you good at sniffing out deception?
I have to say, so I do not fall for the package trick. So they have done that a lot with us at Stanford as a little test. I have almost, I don't want to say 100%, but maybe probably 99.9% success rate with the phishing scams with Stanford that Stanford's putting out. And I'm sort of overly paranoid. Like I'll send them some and say, is this spam? Is this someone trying to manipulate me? And they'll say, well, we don't know, but don't click on it. We'll check. But the thing that is really hard for me are the videos. So you introed me as deep fake. I think this is right, that deep fake for video is where you just can't tell that it's been manipulated. The technology is so good. We've seen some of political personas where their mouth is moving and it looks like they're saying those words. And then you find out 3 days later or 4 days later, no, it was doctored. I get fooled by that because I can't tell. And it's within my realm of thinking they'll say it. You know?
So seeing is believing for you.
I wish that it wasn't, but in some cases, yeah, I definitely am being manipulated. It's really scary. That's
so
scary
to me. This isn't actually Dan talking to you.
you are faking me out. You are, Wizard of Oz behind the curtain is doing stuff.
No, you can tell it's me because nobody else can make so many bad jokes.
It's actually the tone, the voice, the grizzly, you know, that tone of voice that you
have. You could fake that. I could have Seal. Imitate me, the singer Seal.
Yeah, you could have
people imitate. So we're very lucky to have someone who really thinks about media. And this is Professor Jeff Hancock. He's the founding director of the Stanford Social Media Lab, and his faculty position is in the Department of Communications. His group looks at the psychological aspects of social media and how people use social media to deceive, change behaviors, find support. So, Jeff, because you're an academic, I'm an academic, I'm going to try a theory on you. So here's my theory. The worst kind of deception is the kind of deception that makes you not trust anything. So like fake news. So am I right? Am I outside the field, put my finger on the heart of it?
I think so. It's because it comes down to trust. And so much of society, and it turns out our ability to even detect deception, comes down to trust. By default, we are deeply trusting organisms. And it's probably why humans have done so well, is that we have this default trust in each other. When that is removed or undermined, then everything in life becomes even more difficult, brutish, and short.
So that's interesting you say that. So I have a colleague who he's not at Stanford, of course, and he's very manipulative, and I don't trust him, but I can predict him. So I don't mind it. I can predict. So I can trust my own judgments about him.
Well, another way, he's trustworthy, right? You can trust him to not do what he's going to say. And
yes,
there's, yeah. So you can have trust both positively and negatively. One of the definitions I like about trust, because it can then apply in lots of different areas, is sort of the confidence in your expectations about someone or something. And in this case, you're pretty confident that they won't do what they're going to say or are going to try to manipulate you. So as long as they're reliable and predictable, that's good. When we look at the major sort of misinformation campaigns that are out there, the Russian one is the best understood so far. You're right. They're not trying to promote a particular viewpoint, just that it's confusing and there's no one that we can trust, no entity.
So this makes me unhappy when I think about what I need to do in K-12 education. I basically need to teach the kids not to be so trusting. Is that?
No, I think it's actually the opposite. One of my it's funny you started with this, because one of my worries is we've had a really useful and powerful moral panic about fake news. And, you know, it starts in 2016. And for a couple of years, we were just worried that fake news was everywhere and everybody was being manipulated and fooled. And indeed, there was a lot. But as really good science started to come out that looked at what happened in 2016, it became pretty clear that not everybody was being exposed to fake news. It was really targeted at older people, in particular, older people, conservatives. And they were the ones that were much more likely to share it, which means they were probably less likely to detect it. And so it's not because old people are less competent or worse at detecting deception. It's just that they were the ones targeted because they have the most civic engagement. So if you want to influence voters, that's the demographic you have to. They have the most financial resources. So if you're in it for money, which unfortunately the business models of social media are very attention-based, so a lot of fake news is around money, then those are the people to target. I think what happened is we had this moral panic where everybody was worried that everybody's getting all this fake news, when in fact it's quite targeted. So in my classes at Stanford, we'll often do an exercise where I get everybody to look through whatever feed they use the most. So for kids, it's often Instagram. For older people, it might be your inbox, your email inbox. And I had people scan through the last 2 days and see if they could find any fake news. Young people, students in the class that were, typical 18 to 22 years old, none. If I had some visiting, older students in the class, they would find some. And so we're just seeing this again and again. So the problem, I think, is if we just generalize it to like everybody needs to trust less, then we run into that problem we started with. If instead we say, let's work on these critical thinking skills in this new environment, now I think we're back on track.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Dr. Jeff Hancock about media and particularly around deception and how you know when you're getting fooled, which most of the media was designed in some way to manipulate, right? That's why we have the red button telling us you have mail or whatever it is, and the some kind of ding or beep when you get a text. It's all about manipulation, isn't it, Jeff?
Right. We should distinguish between manipulation and deception. So we are manipulated on a regular basis. When I open up a magazine, I'm being manipulated by the advertising to be like, well, that's a really nice car. I should really get that. When I walk into a grocery store, I'm, you know, being manipulated, if we want to use that term. But the deceptive part is what we're really concerned with. So there are companies, advertisers in online spaces that have taken those deceptive practices and ported them online. And one of the worst kinds of things are what we call dark patterns. So these are design techniques online where you're trying to trick people. So the one where it's you're automatically signed up to, after your 7-day trial ends, you're automatically going to be paying $7.99 a month, right? These kind of things. And there's been a lot of pushback for reputable companies and websites to stop using that. So I think we should distinguish between, you know, designers that are trying to get you to pay attention to their stuff, and then these more deceptive, like, we're going to use tricks to get you to do things that aren't what you wanted to ultimately do. But, you know, paying attention to things, I feel we often give technology too much power when we're discussing it, in the sense that we fall into technological determinism. So, okay, a lot of the addiction thinking around phones and media is like, okay, people, kids especially, are addicted to their phones. I can't stand this. Like, if you think they're using it too much, okay, that's one thing. But the addiction is problematic because it says, it's not my fault that I'm using it or that my child is using it. It's the technology's fault, and the technology has all the responsibility. And ignores the fact that we are people, we have agency. Usually we're using the phone or the media for some purpose. In my case, it could be to do work. It could be to connect with my mom. It could be to do my banking. It could be to check where my hockey game is, right? It's everything. And so to give technology too much power takes away our responsibility and ignores our agency.
Sorry, I was just checking my phone. What did you say?
It does lead to distraction, that's for sure.
I'm still trying to think about the kids. So, and that it isn't we as humans should exert control. The challenge is the technology keeps changing so fast. So it's a race to some extent that, gee, I've learned to detect one kind of deception, and somebody clever came up with videos, a deep fake, right? And so I don't know, you know, policy can't keep up with this. And I don't know, can education get ahead of this in general to prepare me for deception when it'll show up in ways I'd never known?
Right. You know, it's the core question. And I think there's only one answer, and that is it has to. And this isn't a short game. This is the long game. And I think it's instructive to think about what the future is going to hold by looking back. And you're absolutely right that the pace of change for technology is dramatically increased. And we react almost the exact same way every time. So you can go back to, you know, pretty early media introductions, but let's start with the radio. When the radio was coming out, there was a really nice piece in 1941, psychiatrist was like watching children listen to radio dramas. And she started talking about real deep concerns. They would consume it like an alcoholic would consume alcohol. They were clearly addicted, and it was going to harm their well-being and their sleep. And now I imagine parents would be like, I would love it if our kids would listen to the radio for a bit. Then you get comic books, exact same moral panic in a way, right, where they're like, okay, now – and there were science articles on this, that it was causing kids to lose their judgment and ability to discern what's real. Then television – it's melting their brains. And then...
but they're all true. Bewitched melted my brain. So.
Well, they're all true in the sense that in the end, all the research, all the meta-analyses show there is no effect of them hurting us in some particular way. But that's not to say that there's no impact of them. They've changed who we are. They change the way we think, and they change the way we talk to each other. But it hasn't been that they've turned us into, you know, narcissists or zombies or any of that. And in fact, people don't even worry about TV very much anymore, even though I think that's a central issue with, you know, kids and iPads. But I think, so I think we want to try to avoid the cycle. And what it comes down to is basically, and this is going to be the hardest thing, especially for your the parents in your audience, is how do we break out of thinking about just screen time? Because on the screen, the children, ourselves, can be doing everything. And so screen time, I think, is wrong way to think about it. You can, if I'm connecting with my kid over a video conference, say, for 10 minutes, versus I'm down a rabbit hole of misinformation about, say, the coronavirus, exact same amount of time, 10 minutes, but one's going to be really healthy for me, and one's going to be really unhealthy for me. And if we just keep thinking about screen time, we're going to lose sight of the fact that we can do everything on those devices. And some are going to be great for us. Some are going to be bad for us. And most of it's going to be in the middle.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Jeff Hancock about media use and both deception and overuse and how not all media is created equal, right? And what you're doing online could be super healthy and introducing you to new friends and new ideas that you haven't thought about before and creating content and art, and other online behavior is kind of scary and putting you down a rabbit hole that isn't good. And it sounds like you're putting a lot of responsibility on adults to help kids see that. Is that, am I reading that right, Jeff?
Right. I mean, I think right now the mindset in some ways from adults and kids are learning it is the addiction time screen. I kind of call it the time dosage model. So it's almost like they're being injected with a certain amount of media, and there's at some point the dose is too much and now you're in trouble. And I don't think that's quite right. Certainly agree that if they're on it too much, doing some kinds of activities like just watching TV for too long can lead to problems like, you know, opportunity costs. They didn't hang out with the family as much, or they didn't do their homework. So there's certainly problems there. But I think the better way to sort of approach it is, what are they doing? What are they trying to accomplish? Like, we forget they're humans and they are trying to do things. So we're trying to encourage a different mindset, which is sort of like a tool mindset, or, you know, one where they have agency. So yes, this is a tool. Phone media is a tool. It's a very, very powerful tool. Maybe one of the most powerful we've ever created. And we will make mistakes, and children will make mistakes, and we will learn from them.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more talking about how to maybe avoid that argument with your daughter, or some nice tips for parents and educators who are attempting to do that, with Jeff Hancock, media specialist, next on SiriusXM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this. Okay. I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Jeff Hancock, who is an expert in all things media. And before the break, we were talking about sort of how you know when someone's doing too much and too little, and deception and manipulation, and a lot of things that parents are worried about, and adults are worried about too.
So let me push back a little bit, and you know the way I like to push back is to bastardize your position. So that,
don't worry, Jeff. He does this with everyone.
Yeah.
He does this with everyone. Don't worry. I'll support you as best I can.
Okay. Right, but the story is technology doesn't make people addicted. People make people addicted. And so we should recognize that children and adults have agency for making decisions about how to use a very powerful tool. At the same time, there's a lot of kids who've been thrust online during, and they're using it a lot. And then there are bad actors.
Yeah.
So there are games that are trying to figure out which reinforcement scheme keeps you playing longer. You know, and if you keep going, then there, you know, maybe you pay some money.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's deception, but it's really manipulative. And it's hard for me to have agency in that context unless somebody has educated me for it.
That's right.
So I want to, anyway, that's a pushback.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair pushback. And there are bad actors online, and there are also these business models that unfortunately don't work well with kids. So for example, YouTube, if you leave your child's autoplay on, the algorithm is going to choose these. And in the end, you know, your kid can be exposed to some really weird and potentially harmful content. So no question there. And games can be designed this way too. And I think there's, multiple prong kind of attack or defense. So one is going to be educating kids. That's the only way long-term for them to be able to be resilient online, is teaching them these techniques and teaching them what happens with them. Why are people doing it? How might they encounter them? And I think that's just going to be crucial. And I work with a not-for-profit here in the Bay Area called My Digital Tattoo. And they work with kids throughout the Bay Area and grade school through high school on how to build these kind of resilience. And so I think that's crucial. The other thing I think to recognize is we're going to make mistakes. And I think that's just important. And we shouldn't assume that we're going to be perfect sort of media users and that kids are going to be perfect media users, and that letting them make some of their own mistakes is going to be crucial, you know, within some boundaries, of course. The last point I'll make is that with the pandemic, there are bad actors that now realize that more and more people, especially young people, are online, and we do need to be more vigilant. So I have some young friends that I've been sort of watching over as they play video games, and we're seeing more and more adults coming into these young kid games, and they'll be playing nasty music, or they'll have soundtracks where it's just swearing, or they'll be linking to some kind of product. Before the pandemic, none of that really ever happened. And so you see these bad actors are trying to come into spaces where kids are. But while recognizing that, we also don't want to panic so much that now you're worried that your kid's getting exposed to terrible stuff every time they're online. And that's where I think we need to balance the panic that we've instilled in so many parents that are just so afraid of everything online that it's leading to these arguments and fear-based decision-making, versus recognizing what actually can kids be doing online that's really valuable.
Yeah, I think it's hard though. I think there's a fear, there's a fear about too much and overuse, right? And that's where a lot of the, you know, put the phone down, we're at the dinner table, put the phone down, you're going to bed, right? It's keeping you up. It's the opportunity cost. But there's also a fear of, you know, online bullying, online predators, like what you just said to me about the game and adults coming in. That's really scary. And you don't know that world as a parent. You know very little about this world, right? The kids are the digital natives. I wouldn't have even known that was happening. I don't know that my kid would have realized it. Mm-hmm. That makes me wonder, how am I supposed to take those actions?
Yeah, it's a good question. I wouldn't have known either. But the 11-year-old that I've been sort of working with and trying, you know, I talk to a lot of kids to try and hear what their, you know, their voice, like, what are they hearing? He was the one that brought it up to me and then brought me in and showed me this. In fact, he recorded some of it. So on the one hand, it's this really disturbing thing. On the other hand, he took the initiative to tell me about it, right? And he told his parents as well. And so I think that's part of it, is if we listen to the kids and we, you know, pre-tech era, we would have seen most of what our kids had done because they'd been doing it around us. Then at some point they would leave and they go into the forest or they go wherever, and they're experimenting with what life is, and it's outside of our views. So we also have to trust our kids a little bit, not to the point of like, just let them off and go. But if your kid comes to you and says, hey, this happened to me online, what a great moment. And that's something that should be really encouraged. And so that's the, you know, ideal way. Of course, it's difficult to always do that, but that's the ideal. It's actually like trusting them and allowing them to come forward when they encounter something that they aren't comfortable with.
Yeah. My solution is to send them emails that say free packages.
So they click. You're bad, Dan. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking with Jeff Hancock about media and kids and sort of danger, positives and negatives, right? What should we go there? Do you want to talk more about?
I have one of the world's experts. There's a question that's not completely apropos of what we've been talking about, but I'd like to know. So has on-demand changed people? It used to be that you had to watch something at a specific time. And I recorded the Super Bowl, and I didn't actually watch it at the time it occurred. And my friends were outraged, right, that I had done this. And usually, you know, the thing only showed up once a week. Now I can wait and just watch like 10 straight hours of it. So is on-demand kind of changing my brain?
Well, the answer probably is yes, of course. Right? And I'm sorry for your brain. No, there isn't at the brain level. There really isn't a lot of good research out there yet, Dan. And it comes back to one of the main problems in science right now is that we're measuring media by saying, hey, how much have you done X? And then asking a question, whatever the dependent variable is, well-being, attention, et cetera. So we're just looking at really simple correlations right now. But there's more work being done with good neuroscience that I hope we'll learn more of that. But I think it's easy to fall into a bit of presentism bias where we think that the way things are now is like the way they'll always be or that they're the right way. And so, you know, the last century was we would all gather around and we would watch things together. And I think that had really great things like building common ground and shared experiences. And that's clearly changing. And it's going to be great in some ways and bad in others, but I don't think that the prior way of consuming media was necessarily the best way. And I can tell from kids that I've been, you know, talking with, that notion of like, why can't I watch it right now is really bizarre. Like, of course you just choose what you want. So their folk theory, if you will, of how media exists is very different from how we grew up, but it's not a bad thing, I don't think.
Okay, so we have just like a very short time left, but I have to ask this question. How am I supposed to know when something is a deep fake? I mean, how can you help me personally get better at not being deceived by videos that look like the person is saying what they're saying and doing what they're doing?
Yeah. So unfortunately, there is no way to know on your own. Deep fakes are still not perfect yet. They will get better. But what I want to say is it's not all bad. It turns out if I was lying to you, Denise, or to Dan, neither of you would be able to tell either.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for being part of our show. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.